and welcome to another Meta Media Group production of On Purpose Magazine, featuring interesting, inspiring, educational, and entertaining stories, discussions, and interviews of purpose, with purpose, on purpose.
Hello, everybody. This is J.W. Najarian, and I'm here today with J.J. French. How are you doing, J.J.?
Doing great, man. Really, really good. And you?
I'm doing super, man. Thanks for asking. I really appreciate it. You're in New York today. I hear we were just talking. You said 103 degrees, 90% humidity.
Yeah, nice, the baked apple. The baked apple, they call it. It's one of those really gross, disgusting New York City hot summer days. So I'm using as much. My carbon footprint is massive. My 5 air conditioners right now. I hate to say. But, you know, you got to stay comfortable in this environment.
Well, we'll plant a tree for you.
Thank you so much. You know, I was just in England. I just came back. You know, their summer completely does not exist this year.
Oh, wow.
It is freezing cold. It's raining constantly. The sun is called an unidentified flying object. it's just the complete flip side. We're having this unbelievable heat wave here, right? An amazing heat wave, and it just keeps on coming out of the Midwest into the Northeast, and we're just getting pulverized by it. But, you know, it's all good. It's all good. Listen, every February when it's like, you know, 20 degrees below zero here in New York, I curse it, and I go, please, Lord, give me 100 degrees and 90% humidity. I will not complain. Well, the Lord delivered. I'm shutting up, okay?
That sucks. You know, we're in L.A. waiting for our 100-degree weather. It's 65 degrees right now in the middle of the day.
You know, I really don't want to hear this from you people out there. Because it always seems to be that you guys have, in general, like a fairly, you know, your climate's always fairly uniform, right? And it's free of humidity. We really get these horrible sticky days, and this is just one of them where if you're in the subway, if you're trying to take a train today, you feel like you're walking in a hair blower. Okay, so I'm staying cool. But anyway, I appreciate your call. And,
no problem. You know, let me, for people who don't know who J.J. French is, I'll just start off with saying you're, the combined guitarist, founder, manager, producer of a band we all know and love, the Twisted Sister. Everybody knows Dee Snider. They may not know your name right off the bat, but you're the guitarist for the band and founder for the band. Going into the bio, you're responsible as a producer and manager for the sale of over 12 million records worldwide, and I understand you have 39 gold and platinum albums from about 8 different countries. You guys have been around for a very long time.
We started really December 72 was the first rehearsal, but for myself, and I was part of the original lineup, of which this band is not this is the band that's known by people, but the story of the band goes back longer than the lineup that exists right now. But I also managed a band called Seven Dust, and I've also played on a lot of records. So the cumulative nature of these 37 or 38 gold and platinum records from all these countries are a byproduct of either my managing Twisted Sister or my being involved in Seven Dust or playing on side projects with other bands. And so it goes, it's a very long, varied history, but it goes back to 72 when I was essentially 20 years old and found myself in a group in New Jersey called Silver Star. Silver Star was a glam band, and we were looking for a more glammy name, and we called ourselves Twisted Sister. And that band took 10 years of evolution to get to the band that is known today, with Mark Mendoza on bass and Eddie Ojeda on guitar and AJ Perro on drums, and myself and Dee. That morphed from 1972 at various points along the way to where it is now. And now, you know,
there was like 11 iterations or something?
Yeah, there are 11 different versions, and the band that made it was the 11th version, essentially. And we are one of only 5 bands currently touring with the lineup that is the record lineup. You know, it's the famous lineup. Usually you go see a band and the cousin's brother's nephew's on drums, or the girlfriend's cousin's brother's on, you know, bass, you know, because the original guy is not there. But this band that is playing is the band that made all the records. So when you see us, there's only five bands that are touring with the original record lineups. Rush is one of them, and Motley Crue is one of them, and Aerosmith is one of them, ZZ Top is one of them, and we're one of them. We're one of five. So it's a very rarefied position to be in a band in which the intact nature of the band is what makes the band so valuable. When you go see a band, you go, wow, that's the group. They're the guys who actually made the record. And that's probably one of the keys to our success these days, because we are probably bigger now around the world than we've ever been. Played bigger crowds. It's more hysteria. It's in many more countries than we did back in the 80s. So we are very fortunate to be survivors.
Well, let me touch on that, because from what I was reading, you guys are obviously well-known in the States, you know, because of songs like, you know, We're Not Gonna Take It and I Wanna Rock. And I understand that Europe is your big crowd.
Europe and South America are massive. And, you know, it's funny because in America, I Wanna Rock and We're Not Gonna Take It are the two most licensed songs from the 80s. So there are more TV commercials, movie soundtracks, movie trailers. They're always being played on something.
Right.
And, you know, right now the Betty White Show uses We're Not Going to Take It as a theme song. We just did a tequila promotion with
Hornitos
Tequila, which they did a mariachi version of We're Not Going to Take It. Rock of Ages movie features two of our songs. And this happens year in and year out. But the band's live following is massive worldwide. So we just finished touring Norway, Sweden, Belgium, Spain. I'm leaving a country out here. Belgium, Spain, and
didn't you do Russia too?
We did. Thank you. Thank you. A small country called Russia.
Yeah.
And you know,
it's forgettable.
And Iowa in the middle of all this. And you go, well, why Iowa? You know, well, they wanted us to play, so we flew from Spain to Iowa, and then from Iowa back to Belgium. You know, kind of
why
crazy.
Not?
Kind of
a rock band. Why not?
We're a rock band. Why not? Right. So. So all of South America, which we did last year for the first time, to huge crowds in soccer stadiums, and in Belgium the crowds are like 70,000, in Sweden there are 50,000, and it's really kind of wonderful to have this life. But the album Stay Hungry, that became so universally huge, became like a coffee table album in a lot of countries. So in Sweden, it's in the top 10 all-time record sales in Sweden, and in various other countries around the world, it's a top 10 all-time record. So that is what I guess it propels the band. Plus, the band is a great live act, and that's really our bread and butter is our live performance. So that's what we're known for.
And you guys you guys have been up and down and up and down. I think you actually even put down the guitar for maybe a decade. Is this? Did you ever think that you'd be talking 30, you know, some years later about your success?
No. In fact, while the band was trying to make it to begin with, we were rejected so many times. Our joke was that we were turned down more times than a bedsheet in a whorehouse. You know, it was unbelievable what we went through, and with the personnel and the stories and the drug and alcohol destruction of the original band members, and what I saw and witnessed with all that. Plus, you know, we played mob-owned bars. You know, Henry Hill, the guy who just died, who was part of the Lufthansa Heist, worked at, you know, was one of the bars that we were in. In fact, the whole crew from Goodfellas worked at that bar. And
right.
So you can imagine, you know, that whole underbelly world that we lived in was pretty crazy. You know, then we became, you know, then we were the biggest bar band, but then we couldn't get a record deal. Then we got this record deal, and then the record label hated our guts, and then we fought and fought and fought. And after 3 years, Stay Hungry came out, and then in 1984, we were one of the top three bands in the world. And by 1987, it all crashed and burned, and everything fell apart and led to multiple lawsuits and bankruptcies and blah, 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 blah. And you had to fight back from that, which is what I did. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, I put the guitar down for at least, I don't know, 5-6 years. Founded the band Seven Dust, got involved with them, had a huge resurgence with them as their manager and producer and their music publisher. And then I went through a divorce and then went through another divorce after Seven Dust and came back again with Twisted. So I guess these are life experiences that when you say, you know, did I ever picture any of it? Frankly, I never pictured any of it, right? It's impossible to ever foresee. You know, when you're 20, you don't know what it's going to be like. Here I am almost 60 with a perspective of 40 years and what I've accomplished, what I've gone through, the ups and the downs, are really extraordinary. And I guess the reason why I'm doing this leadership conference is because I articulate my experiences pretty well. They're universal experiences. They're not just rock and roll experiences. They're business
right.
learning experiences. And it translates well to the broader questions of success and failure.
We're going to be talking about this in a minute, and that's Steve Farber's Extreme Leadership Conference. And you're going to be speaking there, this is August 17th through 19th in San Diego, about, it's just an extreme leadership conference. Put on your business hat, your entrepreneur hat, and talk to us on that level. I understand you're a great storyteller with, the stories of the band, et cetera.
Well, yeah, I am, but I guess I have the ability to speak pretty well extemporaneously, and I've told these stories enough times, and there are definitely life lessons to be learned from them that Steve probably recognized first and said, you really can just go off on this stuff, and it applies to so many different people. But the observations I made as I was climbing up the hill and the destruction of it falling apart and coming back again and so on and so forth, these are universal themes. And recognizing, certain points in your life and how to deal with them really becomes the focus of what I talk about. So with Steve, he helped bring out in me the focus of the path. Right, of the pathway mm-hmm. in explaining this whole story, because the story really is extraordinary. Most people don't know it. And while it's true that a rock band is like a snowflake and there's no two rock bands with the same story, our story is pretty crazy. We celebrated our 9,000th performance last year, and I would put that up against anybody. More shows than Springsteen.
Congratulations.
I would say more shows than The Dead or any of these other bands. We played more shows than anybody, and it shows now because Twisted Sister is an iceberg. What you see on the surface, on stage, is like 3% of what is underneath, and what's underneath is what makes the band so unique, and that's the luxury of having a group that's been together for nearly 40 years.
Right. So would you say, they always say this, but would you agree with this, that it is about the journey?
Well, I would say that, yes, it's about the journey, although while you're in the middle of it, it's damn hard to see that, okay? And that's the problem, because while chaos is surrounding you, it is almost impossible for you to sit there with it and try to put chaos in perspective. But, knowing your playing field, which is really knowing what you're really after, understanding your lifelines, which is how to recognize when something is coming along that you really need to take advantage of as opposed to something to waste your time with, and then how to overcome chaos to achieve order, which is essentially the character development part of it, which is everything is going to be, there's going to be crises coming all the time. Really, it's how you react to the crises. I know it sounds so cliche, but it is so true. Crises really affects you in two different ways. Crises either affects you by happenstance. In other words, something happens you didn't expect it, an illness, a death, maybe a breakup you didn't see, your business falling apart, maybe you didn't see it, right? Those are certain things occur that you have no control over, and then there's the crises that you create in order to grow. Right? Whether mm-hmm. it's you leaving a business or leaving a company or leaving your family or breaking up with, your husband, boyfriend, girlfriend, et cetera, et cetera. So you make these, you grow from these crises that either befall you or you create, and how you react to them is going to basically portend your success or failure in this world. And none of this was obvious to me at the time it was happening, right? I couldn't say to you while it was happening that I was so brilliant that I foresaw my ability to handle this stuff as a precursor to being able to talk about the professionalism. I will say this to you, though, that the entrepreneurial part of me, the survivor in me, wouldn't let the stuff crush me, okay? Not everybody is an entrepreneur. Not everybody is a leader. They're just not. It's statistically, it's just not going to happen.
Right.
If you are one of these people, recognizing these talents and traits, can probably benefit you greatly. I was a survivor. I wasn't going to get myself crushed by this. But, boy, I was confronted with enough stuff enough crazy stuff, whether it was drugs, alcohol, or just the craziness of my band, having my truck stolen by band members, having my trucks blown up by rival club owners, having, you know, the indignity of the record business, you know, crush me, having my band fall apart when we were at the biggest point in our career, and then have file for bankruptcy and have to go through bankruptcy court, and how to come back from that. I mean, you know, the two divorces. I had atrial fibrillations. I had two heart operations. I've run two marathons. You know, and then I have a daughter with an eye disease like uveitis, which then, you know, is a chronic eye disease, and you battle that.
Right.
Well, none of these things occurred to me 40 years ago, right? I didn't know all this was going to be thrown at me, you know, and it all got thrown at me. And luckily, I was able to absorb the hits and react to them and make them and be constructive with it, not destructive with it.
Right. No, and you bring up such a great point because, yeah, it does sound cliche, but it is so true that it's 90% how you react and only 10% what the world throws at you.
This is it.
Let me ask you something, you know, on a different note real quick, and because I want to get back to the business, but one of the things that jumped out at me was, you know, I had a band years ago, and, you know, we were all looking for names, and they named me Johnny Love. And I understood that at one time your name was Johnny Heartbreak.
Yeah, it was. Before Johnny Thunders was Johnny and the Heartbreakers, all that stuff, Johnny Heartbreaker was one of my non-diploms. Yes, it was.
Yeah,
I was also Jonathan Livingston Seagull because my last name was Seagal, so that was kind of cutesy. You know, the first band I was ever in was this is really in 1965. I was in a band with a drummer named Paul Herman and a Chinese singer named Bing Gong, who lived across the street from me, and we called it John Paul and Bingo, just to give you an idea of my sense of humor as a 13-year-old. Right.
Cool.
Then my next band was Five Guys, and we called it Four Rooms and a John. That's another example of my sense of humor.
And you were John.
And I was the John, yes. of when I was 13, 14. So, you know, I kind of always had it. Then when Twisted Sister was trying to figure out its name, I didn't think of the name, but I thought of the Max Factor. I thought, oh, there's a makeup cool. That's a kind of cool name, you know. It's like a glam kind of a thing. And then the original singer had an epiphany during an afternoon of drunkenness at a local bar, and he kind of came up with a name, and he called the house where we were living, and he said, "I got a great name, it's Twisted Sister." And I went, "Well, that really is a great name." When he came back from the bar, he was so drunk he didn't even remember he called. So if no one had picked up the phone, the name would never have been used. So there you go.
Let me ask you this, because you talk about glam rock, and you guys were around, you know, when Kiss was coming up, maybe even before. I don't even know.
Kiss actually formed because I auditioned for them in June of 72. And in September of 72, I saw the finished version. They played a set for me at their loft on 23rd Street. So Kiss was technically together 4 months before Twisted Sister was together.
Ah, okay. So, you know, some people have said, hey, here Twisted Sister came up and they're kind of, you know, working on that whole Kiss thing. And that's just not the truth, is that?
No, absolutely not. Kiss was working on whatever. The kabuki makeup that they were wearing hadn't even been put in place yet. I have a magazine from March of 73 which has Kiss and Twisted Sister in it. New York Dolls on the cover, and we're just two up-and-coming bands. And they had a picture of my band with our look and Kiss with their look. Kiss took this kind of kabuki theater thing, which they still need to do, and we took a more glammy transvestite thing because we were just more into David Bowie and Lou Reed. And Kiss was into, you know, kabuki theater, so it was very, very, very different. I mean, both using makeup as shock value, yes, but completely different approach. Ours was an androgynous sexual ambiguity thing. Kiss had nothing to do with sex thing at all. It was just to be, you know.
Which actually probably scared the hell out of the general public at the time, huh?
Well, yeah, but you had the New York Dolls and Teenage Lust and Eric and the Magic Tramps. You had all these. You had Wayne County, who was a transvestite. So, no, I don't think we were any weirder than any of these bands. It was all the same. We were the New Jersey version of the New York Dolls. We came from the New York area. It wasn't particularly. It was subversive in the suburbs to a degree. Me and my singer the original singer, who was actually a good-looking guy, as opposed to Dee, who looks like Sarah Jessica Parker dipped into that of acid. But the original singer was this beautiful-looking guy, and we used to kiss on. We were chained together with dog collars, and we would kiss on stage during playing Bowie songs, and that was a shocker. But, you know, we did that to get girls because, frankly, you got a lot more girls that way. So I was told this by the drummer. He said, man, we're going to get laid a lot, and trust me, the girls are going to love us. And they did. They loved the guys dressed like chicks. I mean, it was like the greatest chick magnet concept on the planet Earth. So there was a real male ego-driven reason why we dress like women. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to get back. You mentioned a couple of times drugs and alcohol issues, and we're kind of, maybe it doesn't, and not everybody knows, but Twisted Sister, at least the 11th version, you guys were not a big drug and alcohol band, is that correct?
Well, in the early days we were, and that's why there was 11 versions of the band.
Ah.
There was bad drug and alcohol problems in the band, and the band just kept on revolving members because I was really into drugs as a teenager, and I had gotten out of them by the time I was 20. So by the time I joined Twisted or got together with the guys in Wicked Lester, I was straight. And
right.
So I joined a band full of alcoholics, which I didn't know at the time, and I never drank. I'm not a drinker. So I don't really know alcohol well. I don't really get alcohol. I've only had 5 beers in my life, and I'll drink a glass of wine every once in a while, but I'm not a drinker. So I didn't know that these guys are drinking 9 Rusty Nails or Black Russians and, you know, and scotch and sodas and, you know, Jack and Cokes. And they're just getting drunk all the time. And the bass player was drinking a case of beer a day, which I had no idea. And the band was just drunks, a bunch of alcoholics. And it led to a huge fight after about a year and a half. In a drunken stupor, the singer pulled a gun out on the drummer at the time and threatened to kill him. And I walked in on that scene and stopped the fight, which could have led to a murder. And then that band brought other people in. They were methadone addicts. And then they left and they stole the truck and held it for ransom. And then other replacements of them, they were various heroin and or speed and or alcoholics. And we kept on going through members over and over and over again until eventually we pulled a straight band together. So I joined a band to get away from the drug scene in New York, and I run smack into a band that just worshipped, you know, alcohol and drugs and had no idea, and then spent the next 10 years firing everybody until I got a straight band together. So the band I made, it was a straight band, which runs counterintuitive to the music business. We were so straight, we were warned by our management not to talk about it because it would ruin our image. I'm in the only business in which being straight is a terrible thing to do. And you don't talk about it because it could hurt your livelihood. I mean, think about that. Think about the enabling aspect of what the music business is like. In any other business, you know, you do this and it hurts you. In my business, if you don't do it, it really hurts your reputation. So.
Well, yeah, I heard you on your video for the Extreme Summit talk about that whole deal about a rock star pretty much having a free pass as long as you don't kill anybody, being able to do whatever you want to do.
Well, that's it. I mean, you know, we're allowed to be stupid, idiot, you know, adolescents, and, you know, you get a free pass on that. You know, like Keith Richards will do a drug, and, oh, the lead singer of this band screwed around his wife, and it's like with everybody else, oh, my God, how can you do it? My business is, so, pass the sugar, you know, I'm making coffee. I mean, it's accepted. You get away with murder in my business. You can literally get away with murder in my business. So it's kind of interesting to be straight in the middle of it, and that's probably why we've done 9,000 shows and why we're so good is because we apply ourselves to our craft and we're professionals, and we don't, you know, we just don't indulge. That's all there is to it.
Let me ask you this, because, you know, longevity, you know, I'm guessing because of the fact that you guys were up and down, there is some kind of luck factor there, and there usually is in most entrepreneurial systems. Of course, if you don't put the work in or buy the ticket, you'll never win the lottery. But is there a certain part of that is luck, or is it really all hard work?
No. I believe in luck. I believe that what success is, it's a confluence of luck and preparation. All right? Because you'll be turned down a lot, and the problem is, will you be around long enough to take advantage of the time of that one confluence of circumstances that affords you the opportunity, right? If you're not prepared at that very moment, you've blown it. And, you know, without getting into it, on this interview, there was the tipping point. There's always a tipping point. There was a tipping point moment with the band that if we were not prepared at that moment to take full advantage of the opportunity that was finally afforded us after years and years and years of failures and lack of being able to be at the right place at the right time, we wouldn't be having this conversation today.
There you
we
go.
Simply wouldn't. Our history would have gone nowhere, and it would have been the end.
Wow. Let me ask you, because, you know, you're not only a savvy businessman and an entrepreneur, but you're also a philanthropist. Sometimes because stuff happened, and in one case, New York Steel, because you felt like you wanted to do something. Did you
well,
that, New York Steel real quick, and then I wanted to
sure.
Talk about.
You know, the band had broken up. The band hadn't talked in 12 years, and then VH1 had done a Behind the Music that was broadcast in August of 2001, and it was edited in such a way that it was really awful and as badly, rather as.
Well, it made you guys look like you hated each other. Right?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was edited in such a negative way that after I watched the end result, I said, "There's never any idea the band will ever get back together. Just never happen." And then
right.
2 weeks later, 9/11 occurred. And the day after 9/11, I went to volunteer down at the Javits Center to do something because I felt helpless, as most New Yorkers did. I mean, it was so traumatic. You can't even
right.
talk about it as a New Yorker. Anyone who was here that day and lived through it still can't believe it happened, right? You can't believe it. I watch it. I don't believe it. I still can't digest it. But the bottom line is I went down to the Javits Center, and they said, well, if you're not a policeman, fireman, iron worker, doctor, paramedic, lawyer, blah, blah, probably we can't use you. And I said, man, I can't believe I'm a New Yorker. I can't do something for my fellow New Yorkers. And at that point in time, a DJ contacted me, a metal DJ named Eddie Trunk, and he said, listen, we're going to do a benefit for the New York City Police and Fire Department, the Widows Fund for the New York City Police and Emergency
right.
Care Workers. And I said, you know what, I'm going to call the guys in the band. He said, God, you guys haven't played in 12 years, and it would be great if you could do it. And I called everyone up, it really made me feel good because the guys all said, whatever, you know, we'll play because this is way more important than our stupid, petty arguments. And That reunion, the New York Steel reunion, it was called New York Steel. It was us, Anthrax, Sebastian, Bach, Overkill, and Twisted Sister, raised $100,000 for the New York City Police and Fire Department's Widows and Orphans Fund. And that led to the world knowing that we were back, and that led to the reunion. However, we do benefits all the time. I mean, we went to Korea, played for the troops following that. We do fundraisers all the time. My daughter's charity, which is the Pink Burst Project.
That's the second thing I wanted to talk about. The
research.
Pink Burst Project.
We've done benefits for that. We do it for muscular dystrophy, Bikers for Babies. We did a policeman was murdered in Poughkeepsie last year, John Falcone. We did a concert to raise money for his family. We've become, this has become a cause for us to give back because we've been so fortunate. So we do at least one show a year in which we do a benefit to raise money for some cause. And in my case with my daughter, you know, here I was, this isn't like a third-party issue. This is directly with me. My daughter was diagnosed with uveitis, which is an inflammatory eye disease. She was diagnosed at the age of 6. It's incurable. It's treatable. It can go into remission. It's a complicated disease. It's the leading cause of blindness among girls in America. You know, as a parent, all of a sudden you have to learn about something you never heard about. Uveitis, I thought it was UV rays. You know, what is uveitis?
Right.
The uvea is the middle lens of the eye, and it's about the accumulation of cells that destroy, and inflammation that destroy the middle lens of the eye, cause glaucoma and blindness. If untreated, and the cells attack the eye for reasons they don't know, like much like arthritis attaches cells attach a joint, it is
right.
in fact like arthritis of the eyes. It can be idiopathic, meaning it can just be in the eyes, or it can be symptomatic of a larger systemic disease like juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. And, you know, it can be part of a whole morass of diseases, or it can be alone. In my daughter's case, so far, it's just been alone. It's just been idiopathic in her eyes. She's been taking very heavy immune suppressive drugs for 12 years, and she's been in remission for 2 years on the drugs. This summer, they're weaning her off the drugs to see if she can stand alone on herself and we
wow.
By herself.
Cool.
But we raise money for the foundation because there is no cure, and, you know, education is important. If your child is diagnosed with uveitis at the age of 5 or 6, where it usually hits, and you get to the right doctor soon enough, you can preserve that child's sight. If, however, the child has the disease and it goes unnoticed for several years, which it can because it's got no taste, no smell, the destruction can occur to the sight and the child not even know it. By the time you find it 2 or 3 years later, the damage is permanent. So we preach early detection and treatment. And that's that's what's close to my heart right now.
That's great. JJ, tell me where people can, you know, if they hear this and want to know more, where they can go to get more information on
if you, if you, well, project. Very simple. If you just go to Google and you put uveitis in, it'll all come up. So uveitis is uveitis, right? It's uveitis. And if you, but it, the Ocular Immunology and Uveitis Foundation is the foundation that's run by Dr. Stephen Foster, who's the world's preeminent specialist in uveitis out of the Mercy Hospital in Massachusetts, which is, stands for Massachusetts Eye Research and Surgery Institute, Mercy. It's M-E-R-S-I. So Mercy Hospital, M-E-R-S-I, uveitis, ocular immunology. If you put inflammatory eye disease, it'll all come up to uveitis. If you want to learn about it, if you want to donate to it, it's easy enough to Google it and to find the information out and to donate to the Ocular Immunology and Uveitis Foundation.
Well, thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it. Let's talk about business and the conference.
Okay.
The reason we're, one of the reasons we're talking, or the reason we've been brought together, and thank you very much for doing this for us, is that you're going to be speaking. You're going to be a speaker at the Extreme Leadership Summit in August. That's August 17th through 19th. That's Steve Farber's first event over in San Diego. And you're going to be talking, you're going to, first of all, I understand you went to SOBCON, so you must know Liz Strauss.
Absolutely.
Yeah, she's brilliant. She's one of my faves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you meet a lot of people. Well, that's where you met Steve Farber.
That's right. I went with my girlfriend who was she was the social media blog person at Forbes, right? She had a the technical words for what she did was, I'm just trying to think about it now, but she set up these networks, right, of bloggers, and there was a woman's I don't know, department, for lack of a better phrase, but so she was in charge of developing the blogosphere, I guess, is really what it is. And through her, I met a lot of people, and we went to SOBCON because so many of the people who she interacted with, right, she said, you guys got to go to SOBCON. So I went with her because she was going to be on a panel, and I said, listen, you come to my shows all the time, so I want to come and support you. You know, this is your world, not my world. I don't know anything about it, so I'll just sit back and you guys have a good time. And I Steve was there speaking, and he was brilliant. My God, he was really great. And I think I raised my hand to ask a question or to give an opinion based on what he said. And the next thing you know, they asked me to be on a panel, and I said, I don't know why I'd be on a panel. I don't bring anything specific to this panel. I can only give you some broad-based responses, right? Well, it turns out that what I learned from that was that most of the people there were entrepreneurs who really wanted to know about succeeding in business and that this was a pathway for them, but they needed a larger picture, right? So it was through that Steve said, God, you know, your experiences are universal. The fact that it's cloaked in rock and roll is sexy and gives insight that most people don't have, but these are really universal and people wouldn't expect that your issues and your challenges are the same as ours.
Right.
But at the end of the day, business is business, right? It is business.
Right.
You know, and I said, yeah, the thing I've always felt about the music business was it says sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but there's one word missing in that. It's called money. And you know, and who watches that? And how do you do that? And that is kind of what kind of brought us together, was his going, wow, these stories are incredible, and what you went through was incredible, and your insights are so unique to what you do, and people would be interested. So this is how it all came together.
And did you, you know, as a manager, founder, manager, and the person kind of responsible for making sure things worked, and did you have times when you didn't work well with the money or didn't do that well with the whole thing?
Well, here's the difference. You know, there's a phrase in this world that I absolutely believe in, which is there's three kinds of people. There's people who make it happen, people who watch it happen, and people who go, what happened?
Right.
I learned many years ago to never be the kind of person to go, what happened? I may not like what happened. I may have fought whatever happened, but I'm never going to go, what happened? So while things weren't always perfect. I'm not the guy who go, man, I don't know what happened. We had money, and then we didn't have any money. And somebody ripped me off. No, I know where every penny went. I know every bad decision. You know, I know it all. I don't sit there. It's not mystifying to me. It is not mystifying at all. It's depressing. It's unfortunate. You can do better. You learn from your mistakes. But I just read the Keith Richards book. Those guys got screwed, and they didn't know they got screwed. And when they found out they got screwed, it was too late. And, you know, to Keith's credit in the book, and, of course, he's a multimillionaire now, so he's not crying all that much. You know, he describes, you know, when people say, well, you lost all your music publishing from 1962 to 1970. You don't know own the rights to anything. Satisfaction is one of the most, is the biggest song in the history of the world, one of the biggest. And he goes, well, you learn from your mistakes. I'm going, well, it's nice that you can be that philosophical about it. And, of course, it's either that or you kill yourself, right?
Right.
But you do tend to learn. But I'm not one of those guys who goes, what happened? Under no circumstances. So everything that befell the band, everything that ever came to me, I saw it coming. I could either stop it, change it, morph it, or let it hit. But I wasn't surprised by any of it. That's really the key. I wouldn't allow myself.
You made some savvy decisions. I mean, you've learned the music business. I understand that the hit that everybody hears on all the commercials is something you re-recorded so that you wouldn't have to pay record companies. Am I
That's true.
Way off?
That is something that we pretty much pioneered, the re-record, which people didn't do, and we re-record all of our hits and we sell our own versions of it, and the record companies don't get their hands on them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a bone of contention, but I don't really care. They were screwing me, and they didn't give a damn, so why should I feel terrible for them? I actually had a record company guy go, you know, it really upsets us what you did. And I said, really? Didn't upset you too much when you were, like, making us sign record deals that gave us, you know, the worst royalty rate since Moby Dick was a minnow? I don't really think so. You know, I find it offensive when they claim, you know, all kind of moral indignation when a record contract is probably one of the most egregious forms of slavery known to mankind. It's one of the only businesses in the world in which you create something, you don't own it. You pay it back the cost of making it, and you still don't own it. You pay it back on a royalty level basis that they give you, and it's the worst in the world, and you still don't own it, even after you pay it back. I mean, it really is indentured servitude at a level that's kind of illegal. I mean, it's catastrophically terrible.
Yeah, you know, I was just talking to Kurt Smith of Tears for Fears, and you know, he's using the internet to distribute and do all his stuff, and he was just saying that, you know, hey, they don't pay you a big check and you just make all this money. They give you a loan, essentially. You know, record companies still charge for breakage on digital material. Oh, they're just ripping people off right and left.
It's beyond. I could get into it with you, but
yeah.
But the reality is, you sell 2 million records, you're a 5-man band. Essentially, what you make on it is $50,000 each when all the expenses are taken out. So, I could go through it with you line by line, but there's no time to do it right now.
That's okay. We get the picture.
But the bottom line is, it's an atrociously bad business, and it's constructed in a Ponzi scheme way. And it's a nightmare. And this is why, by the way, most musicians who've been signed to record deals are not bemoaning the loss of the record industry. I get the fact that it's a drag, that the record industry is falling apart. I get the fact that the dream is gone. I get the fact that bands who one day wanted to have a platinum album have a platinum album and don't have it anymore. I get that. But most bands who've been subjected to that nonsense want them all to die. You know, they want them all to crash and burn because they hate them so much because they've been abused
so
badly.
Well, you know, this big misrepresentation, maybe it's by Hollywood or, you know, what, you know, the glam of the whole deal, and that is that a band that goes out there and they're really great, somebody discovers them, you know, a PR person finds them from a record company, throws $1 million at them, and they become millionaires. But the truth is, the PR people, they don't even have to like your music. You have to have a following first, or they're not even going to talk to you. Is that true?
Well,
I mean, is it really hard to just be?
Are you talking about today, or are you just talking about in general?
I'm talking in general, but today even
today
more.
You need a big following for anybody to even recognize you.
Yeah,
and it's understood because the business is so bad right now.
So there's right a lot of great bands out there, but that doesn't mean without a following, that doesn't mean they're going.
It doesn't mean anything. And besides which, I've known phenomenal musicians all my life who've gone absolutely nowhere. I call them basement Mozarts. They're impossible to get out of their own way. They're stupid beyond belief. And just because they're incredibly talented doesn't mean they're going to be successful. Look, I'm not necessarily the most talented guitar player out there. What I am is a really Gord Eiland is a business person who plays guitar as opposed to a guitar player who's a business person.
Right.
I'm really the other way around. I'm a business guy who said, you know what, I better play guitar so I can control this even better. I'll be in the band. I'll be able to get a handle on it. So I'll know enough guitar to get a record deal. And to be a rock, I don't know, to be a rock star, I can't say that there's no guarantees of that. But I'm much more of a business guy who's a musician than a musician is a business guy. And not that I have anything against pure musicians, because some of my best friends are amazing musicians. But interestingly enough, the most successful musicians I know don't know how to read a single note. And the best musicians I know are broke or studio guys. So, you know, that's just the strangeness of the... I want to be a rock star. I didn't want to be a musician. There's a huge difference.
There you go.
There's a huge difference.
I don't want to take go too far, because I want people to come to the enlightened.
Trust me. There's lots.
Yeah.
There's lots of stuff here. So
okay. So going to be speaking there. This is at the Extreme Leadership Summit in San Diego on the 17th through the 19th. Go to www.extremeleadership.com and you can sign up and register and find hotel rooms and all that good stuff. Tell me, what are you going to be speaking about, essentially? Do you know yet, or are you just going to
get there? Well, I think there's going to be about a half a dozen topics.
Right.
That we're just going to cover chronologically, from what I think you need to, how you need to view it. And that's what that's really what it's going to be. I mean, Steve talks about, essentially it's the pathways to success. It's recognizing the pathways to success and just understanding what you're being confronted with and how to approach it. And that's, but through the eyes of a rock and roller, essentially.
There you go. You're not the only speaker. We're going to have Brian Main, from Chairman Lift International. We have Liz Strauss, who we've been speaking about. She was voted by Forbes, by the way, and Huffington Post as one of the 10 top influential women in social media today. Mm-hmm. We have Tommy Spaulding, the Fifth Floor Relationship author of It's Not Just Who You Know, Simon Bilberry, Sally Hogshead, Lauren Slocum, and of course Steve himself will be speaking. And it's just going to be, are you going to be able to stay, by the way, for the whole thing, or are you going to have to fly out?
No, I'm really coming for the whole enchilada.
Wow.
Nice. I'm going to get there early. I'm watching everybody. I'm
nice.
Going to, this is a learning, just as much of a learning experience for me as anything else. So to me, I'm really here to get I want the full Monty here.
There you go. Well, I'm going to be at the conference. I'll get to meet you there, and I really look forward to that. We're coming up to the end here. Is there a parting word you'd like to say about business leadership, or why somebody should be at this conference?
Well, I didn't have the benefit of this kind of insight when I was 20. And I think if I did, I would have been a lot more prepared. I mean, I did learn the hard way. I did get my head kicked in. Literally and figuratively, and I never had anybody show me the way or explain it to me or give me any insight whatsoever. I was really just, I held my nose and jumped in. And while it sounds romantic and it sounds wonderful, there's nothing wrong with getting some guidance. And I think that's what really makes this important. When I listen to Steve speak, for example, he makes my blood go. He wants you to go deep inside and reach for something. Reach for something that you haven't thought of, and be proud of going for it. And I think that's really what it is. It's about, giving you enough insight for you to get through another day and to really go for it. Because at the end of the day, especially entrepreneurs, we live in a lily pad world, meaning that you need something every day just to give you enough to get to the next day. Because sometimes, that's all you need. You just need some validation somewhere along the line, some tidbit. What is the validation? In my case, my validation was based on situations with the band. In this case, when anyone who comes to this stuff, comes to these kinds of talks, this will be validation. They will recognize within themselves certain qualities. They're either going to relate to them and say, you know what, that is me. And if these guys can do it, I can do it. Or maybe they'll go, that's not me. And maybe I should just go back to school and, you know, do something else. But hopefully you'll recognize enough pathways that when you leave a conference like this, you're better equipped to handle the world in your future.
Well, that's excellent. And I think that even somebody who decides that maybe being an entrepreneur is not their path, that they can still get a lot from a summit like this and being around leaders and people who these are authentic leaders. These are people who have actually had business, made business successful, and, you know, just in your regular life. I mean, Steve Farber teaches about love, you know, using love in business. You know, this is not just about business all the time. Sometimes it's about just how you deal with life, period.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important for anybody. But listen, I really, really appreciate you, J.J., for coming on. This is J.W. Najarian speaking to J.J. French, the guitarist, manager, and founder of Twisted Sister. And J.J., thank you so much for your time. I know you're taking, you know, you just got off tour. You know, I'm sure you just really need some rest. You want to kick back a little bit. But so I appreciate you really giving me some decent time today. It was really nice of you.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. This is J.W. Najarian for On Purpose Magazine. Everybody have a great day and an even better tomorrow.
Thank you for listening to our Meta Media Group production of On Purpose Magazine. You can find On Purpose Magazine at onpurposemagazine.com. On Purpose Magazine and J.W. On Purpose is the property and is a trademark of Meta Media Group, and this audio is copyright 2012, and all rights are reserved.